It's a great pleasure to be here and to participate in this extremely interesting conference. I'm really enjoying the way people are struggling to find common languages and to identify what really are the important problems to work on. So I'd like to present to you something old and something new. And I might have something borrowed and something blue as well, but we'll see what happens. I wrote up here references to two papers. One was an article in Science, which was, I think, called Quantum Limits to Measurement. So this is actually, along with development of the theory of physics of computation, which comes partially out of quantum computation over the last 15 years or so, this is really a rather golden age for the physics of measurement, of figuring out what the limits are to measurement. In particular, for many, many decades, there were a bunch of limits called the standard quantum limit. Now, the standard quantum limit comes when these are a series of limits that look something like the Heisenberg uncertainty limit. And what happens if you assume that you have semi-classical states of light or matter, and then you try to build measurement apparatuses out of them. Actually, it turns out the correct plural apparatus is apparatus, because apparatus is a fourth declension Latin noun. But somehow, if you say apparatus, nobody knows what you mean. So I'll call them apparatuses. It's not apparati, by the way, that's completely incorrect. So if you build apparatuses using semi-classical states, you get to these things that are called things like the standard quantum limit. And they say things like, you know, if you want to measure phi, the phase of a harmonic oscillator, to an accuracy delta phi, then you have something like delta phi basically goes as 1 over the square root of the number of photons that you use in order to make your measurement. Which makes some kind of sense, okay? Like, if you have a bunch of photons, each one has, or a bunch of modes of this oscillator, let's say they're each single photon modes, you measure each of one separately, the delta phi comes because you get some accuracy from each one, and the square root of n comes because these measurements are uncorrelated with each other. Okay. And a famous example of that the measurement of time is the example from 1953, I think. Maybe it was 57, I can't remember, of Wigner's clock, where Wigner gave a limit if he assumed that a clock was just simply a massive particle moving along, but its position was correlated with time, then because you have uncertainty in its momentum, its wave packet spreads out because there's dispersion, and after a certain point in time, you won't be able to measure time any longer. This is a good example of so-called standard quantum limits. But what's become clear over the last decade or so, is that these are not really limits. They may be standard and they may be quantum, okay, but they're not limits. And in fact, they can be surpassed, often by using sneaky quantum techniques such as entanglement and squeezing. But even, in fact, as it turns out, an ordinary atomic clock, in a strong sense, is not subject to the same limits that Wigner's clock is subject to. For the simple reason that, as atomic clocks, as we'll discuss in a bit, are non-dispersive in their time evolution. Okay, and so by the way, this is a colloquium, so it's supposed to be for a very broad audience. But I happen to know that there are a bunch of really incredibly knowledgeable specialists here in this audience. And so every now and then I'm going to say something which is for the specialists. So if sometimes I say something which sounds like complete gobbledygook, then just like ignore it, right? It's like when Charlie Brown is sitting reading Brothers Karamazov, and Linus goes to him and says, "Charlie Brown, I see you're reading Brothers Karamazov. How do you deal with all those long Russian names?" And Charlie Brown says, "Oh, when I come to one, I just bleep right over it." Right? This is actually a good way to read scientific papers, may I say. It's like, when you come to like one of those long equations you don't understand, just bleep right over it. Maybe you'll be able to still figure out what's going on. Okay. So the latter part, so this paper is a review of these quantum limits and measurements. It's by Vittorio Giovannetti, Lorenzo Mocconi, and me. And in the last part of it, I talk about quantum limits to measuring space and time. So the first part of the talk, I will actually basically be reviewing stuff that was in this paper about one of the quantum limits to measuring space and time, because the paper goes into great length about the quantum limits to measuring how accurately a clock can tick out time, and how accurately signals can be, the time of departure and arrival signals, say made out of electromagnetic waves, can be timed. And this turns out to be a good way to talk about limits to measuring space and time. And then this more recent paper, which actually I just posted it at 12 today, because I thought it would be good for people to have the paper on which this talk is based. So it might be a little bit rough in its current form, but it's pretty much what you'll be hearing about today. In this paper, I take this a lot further. In the second half of my talk, I will tell you how we can go from just a general picture of what the quantum limits to measuring space and time are to actually, in effect, deriving Einstein's equations from those limits. So I'm going to claim and show you how it can be done that Einstein's equations, in some sense, arise in a very natural way from these fundamental quantum limits to measuring space and time. I understand this is an audacious claim, and I'm sure I will not satisfy many of the people here, but I'm going to make it anyway. What the hell, right? Okay. Okay. So that's what it's going to be. Part one is going to be reviewing what these quantum limits are. Part one and a half is going to, where the middle part is going to be actually essentially making these limits covariant, general relativistically covariant, and the last part will be showing how you can actually start from these limits and derive Einstein's equations. Are there any questions? What? Is that clear? Anything else people want me to cover while I'm here? I can do anything you want, right? This is like, think of me as like some like interactive interface where you can point and click. Yeah?
Looking up that identifier, it doesn't exist.
Yeah, that's because I just posted it at noon today.
Okay.
So it has it should be out there by tomorrow. Oh, it's a temporary one? Okay. Well, anyway, it should be out there. Whatever it means, it should be out there tomorrow. That's assuming that it doesn't just get written, assuming that the person who actually vets crazy papers is not here in the audience and decides to quash it.
What's the one at the
top? That one is quant pH 0412078. That's okay. Yeah?
Why would you suspect something like general relativity would have the limits of quantum?
You wouldn't. This is actually quite surprising. I claim that this is quite surprising. In fact, there are going to be a bunch of things which when I first figured them out, I found very surprising. Right. So in fact, you can think of this as being a measurement-based analog of Ted Jacobson's 1994 PRL about deriving space and time Einstein's equations from the entropy area law together with the fact that accelerated observers see horizon radiation. So in fact, if you know that paper, if you're familiar with that paper, what I'm going to tell you will actually slide down easily, because it's like, you know, it's like drinking a margarita with just a different kind of tequila and with lemon instead of lime or something like that. So I'm glad that there are people in the audience who are familiar with that paper, because then you'll understand how this is going to work, which otherwise might be a little tough. Okay. Any more requests and questions? Right, sorry about this. Maybe I'll just erase this. I should just say to appear tomorrow. Tomorrow. Indeed, I just found a typo on the manuscript, so I'm going to have to replace it. But I guess I get a grace period there. Okay. All right. So let's actually look at how these quantum limits to measuring space and time work. And to do that, I'm basically going to quantize the global positioning system. This is how I'm a professor of mechanical engineering at MIT for historic reasons. Don't ask me why, since I never studied mechanical engineering. But I felt that when I got there, I should do stuff that like a serious mechanical or quantum mechanical engineer should do. Like look at things like, you know, control theory and sensor theory and stuff like that. And this is how a mechanical engineer, or maybe a quantum mechanic, tries to quantize gravity. It's like, we're going to look at how you measure space and time, and we're going to then quantize the stuff that we use to measure space and time. This, by the way, is an idea that was put forward a long time ago by Carlo Rovelli, and it's actually a very nice idea as you look at it. So, here is our picture of space and time. Here is time, and anything having to do with gravity at all, time always goes up. Sort of like a hopeful way of thinking about the world. You know, for engineers, time goes from left to right. For physicists, it goes from right to left. Right. But for people who do gravity, it goes from bottom to top, which is lovely. It's hopeful, right? I'm suppressing two of the dimensions here because I can't draw them. All right. So. So in GPS, what is GPS about? GPS is about a bunch of clocks that are zipping through space, let's say falling inertially through space, so let's consider them to be following inertial geodesics, ticking as they go. So at some time later, this clock reads something else. Here's another clock zipping around through space. This one's, let's say this one is going really fast, as this would suggest. If the speed of light is 1 here, so it doesn't take that much. Here's another clock. This one's, we're basically in the rest frame of this clock, so this clock is actually going a lot more ticks than these other ones that are moving fast. And they send signals to each other, back and forth, and they record the time of arrival, time of departure of each signal, and the time of arrival of each signal. And GPS signals tell which clock they came from and when they left that clock. So this is an amazing system. It allows you to know, you know, localize where you are in space and time to within a, you know, a nanosecond or a meter or so. Pretty remarkable. Now, who invented GPS? Who invented GPS? It's not just Arda, right? Who is the person who came up with the idea for GPS? Arthur C. Clarke talked about it, but no, the answer is actually Einstein invented GPS. That if you look at Einstein's, when he starts talking about general relativity, Einstein was very fascinated with the question of clock synchronization, as was Poincaré at the time, because, in fact, there's a wonderful book about this called Einstein's Clocks, Poincaré's Maps, that talks about this ferment of trying to get the trains to run on time. Back at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, when they realized, hey, we gotta like have clocks that are synchronized from place to place, and how are we gonna do it? Okay. Poincaré prevented the French government from tearing down the Eiffel Tower after the exposition for which it was built, because he said, look, we'll have a time signal that's sent out from the top of the Eiffel Tower to all the region around Paris, and they kept it for that. But Einstein's paradigm for understanding how we measure space and time, he had one involving, oh, we have like rulers and things like that, but his other one was imagine a bunch of clocks falling inertially through space, sending signals back and forth, and recording the times of departure and the times of arrival, and this allows us to figure out, you know, the geometry of space-time, be it flat or be it curved. So it began life as a Gedanken experiment, and now, 100 years later, is you know, a basic fact of life. And an amazing fact of life, because the GPS system is a really remarkable feat of engineering. And in fact, for doing these quantum limits to measurement, I had to learn a lot about how GPS actually operates, which is actually startling, because in fact, and scary in some sense, because if a solar flare comes through and ionizes a chunk of the atmosphere, all of a sudden it changes the rate of propagation of light through the atmosphere, and all of a sudden you're 400 meters from where you think you should be, which should make you worry. Planes fly using GPS, right? Okay, so everybody happy with this picture? So what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna use this picture to derive these quantum limits to how accurately you can measure space and time. So in particular, I'm gonna look at what I'm gonna call a spherical volume, some sub-volume of GPS of radius r, and I'm gonna follow it over some time t. And I'm going to ask, in this sub-volume of GPS, of my GPS network, how accurately can these clocks and signals map out space and time? And I'm going to talk about clocks and signals, but it turns out that this is going to be, the limits are going to hold for anything that can map out time and anything that can map out space, because this will be a very general result. Okay. So there are two basic theorems that help you figure out how what these limits are. So the first is what's known as the Heisenberg relation, for reasons that will be eminently clear, which says that delta E, delta T is greater than or equal to actually what turns out to be pi h bar over 2. For continuous variables, it's like h bar. For discrete variables, it turns out to be pi h bar over 2. And this is a very funny relation. It has been misinterpreted many, many, many times in the course of its history. Even Heisenberg himself, I believe, claimed that this meant if you wish to measure the energy of a system to an accuracy delta E, you need time delta T that's greater than h bar over delta E. This is actually completely incorrect, as was shown by Aharonov and Bohm in 1960. It's caused so much confusion that in Asher Peres's beautiful book about the foundations of quantum mechanics, if you look up energy-time uncertainty relationship in the index of the book, it says, go to page 433, and you look for page 433, and that's the page that you're on right there. So the only mention of it in the book is the index pointing to itself. Check it out. Okay. But what is a reasonable interpretation of this limit? As we'll see in just a second, I'll give some examples, but not to prove this, but to make it plausible. This actually says, if I have a system, and I wish it to evolve from one state to an orthogonal state, so go from state to orthogonal state, in time delta t, so delta t is the amount of time it takes to go from this state to an orthogonal state, like the amount of time it takes a bit to flip, right? Or a clock to tick, or a detector to click. Then the spread in energy of that system must be greater than or equal to pi h bar over 2 delta t. Okay? And I'll make this plausible in just a second. And there is a related theorem, perhaps less well known, but equally deserving of being known, called the Margolis-Levitin theorem, named after Norm Margolis at MIT and Lev Levitin at BU. And that says E delta T is greater than or equal to pi h bar over 2, where E is equal to the expectation value of the energy, so maybe I'll say trace rho h, over the ground state energy. So if you wish to flip faster, you need more energy. This actually makes, in some sense it's not so clear why this is true. This is very easy to prove. It's really just the Cauchy theorem. You know, if you say delta E is equal to h bar delta omega, then this claims in the Fourier transform of a function, delta omega delta t, is greater than or equal to something around pi over 2, which was proved probably by Fourier even before Cauchy. So this is easy to prove. This is harder to prove, but in some sense, the Margolis-Levitin theorem makes more sense. It says, if you want to do something fast, you got to put in more energy. And you know, I don't think you have to be a physicist to know that that's true. All right? So are there questions about this? Let me give an example one example which will saturate both of these bounds and you'll kind of see what's going on here. Sorry. Okay. So our example is the following. We have a system in the state plus, which is 1 over square root of 2. I'll call it a 0 plus 1. It is a qubit, okay? And this is the ground state, and this is the excited state, all right? And this evolves in the excited state has energy E1, so E0 we'll call 0, and E1 we'll call h bar omega. And so this evolves over time as e to the minus I omega delta t. And after a time, when delta t is equal to pi divided by omega, then this goes to the state minus, which is equal to 1 over the square root of 2, 0 minus 1, which I think people will agree is an orthogonal state. Now, let's look at the spread in energy. The spread in energy, so the average energy, is h bar omega over 2. That's right here. 0 is energy 0, and 1 is energy h bar omega. So the spread in energy is h bar omega over 2. Okay? And similarly, the average energy, trace h rho minus e naught is 0. Well, this is the top energy. The average energy is halfway between. It's also equal to h bar omega over 2. And if you pop these in here, you'll see that this single qubit that's flipping from one state to another is actually exactly saturates this Heisenberg relation and this Margolis-Levitin theorem. Okay? Are people fine about this? And you can prove that this one is easier, this one is harder, but you can prove that you can't do better than that. All right? And then there's a whole set of related results, by the way, which I'd like to advertise, this whole set of like what my colleagues and I call the quantum speed limits. So quantum speed limits that tell you, you know, well, how fast can you get from this state to something that, you know, only has overlap 0.3 with the original state? There's a set of functions that allow you to determine how rapidly you can do that in terms of delta E and of E. Another interesting feature is if you wish to go through a whole sequence of orthogonal states, not just one state. You notice that this only has two orthogonal states, and it goes there and then it comes back. If you want to go through a whole sequence of orthogonal states, like a very large number of them, then these limits get doubled. So I get delta E delta T has got to be bigger than pi h bar. E delta T is greater than or equal to pi h bar. And it's interesting to think why that's so. Anyway, it's the case. Okay. So are people cool about this? Make sense? And now let me apply this to this GPS, because these limits are going to apply. Specifically, I'm going to apply this Margolis-Levitin theorem, if I can find that nice piece of blue chalk I had. I'm going to apply this one to GPS, because this is going to prove to be quite useful, for the simple reason that energies add up over time, over space. If I have two, you know, the energy here plus the energy there, modulo the interaction energy between two regions of space and time, energy adds up, and that will allow us to limit the number of ticks of clocks and clicks of detectors that go on within this volume of space and time. And let me erase this over here. Oh, nice. Who'd have thought it would look like that? Looks great. If only everybody were so accommodating to people who hate PowerPoint, like me. Because PowerPoint is, of course, a tool of Satan. It's true. Like, you know, forcing you to put everything in terms of bullet points, right? Sapping our strength in endless, mindless meetings. It's awful. Okay. So, now let's apply this Margolis-Levitin theorem to this quantization of GPS. What is the maximum number of ticks of clocks / clicks of detectors, for that matter, bit flips of bits that can go on in this volume? Well, simply applying this Margolis-Levitin theorem to all the things that are going on in the volume says that this has got to be less than or equal to the energy of the stuff in this region of space and time calculated above its ground state energy, okay? It's important because, you know, in ordinary quantum mechanics, including the quantum mechanics of clocks and of detectors and of signals, in ordinary quantum mechanics, the ground state energy should not matter. And that's what this Margolis-Levitin theorem says. It's just some arbitrary number that's in there. This, of course, is going to be very interesting when we come back later and look at general relativity, when the ground state energy might very well matter. And I had to bring this up because I know that there are people out there who are discussing this with at lunch who would otherwise have jumped up and say, but general relativity matters. Okay? So, this is less than 2e times t over pi h bar. That's fine. But this t is the total length of the volume. I just count up the energy that's going into each of these ticks and clicks. And I ask, all right, how many ticks and clicks did I have, given the amount of energy I have? I add it all up, and I find, well, the total number of ticks and clicks, clocks and clicks of detectors or bit flips is less than or equal to 2e over pi h bar. All right? So that's great. On the face of it, it looks like there's no limit to how accurately you can measure out space and time. You just like pop in more clocks, have them tick faster, put in more signals. It's great. You can like map out fit space time to very, very tiny degrees of freedom. You put in more and more and more energy. But what happens if you try to put too much energy into some space-time volume? Look, I'm a professor of mechanical engineering. I need feedback. right. So yeah, please. So I'm capable. I lived in England for years. I'm capable of like undergoing such long, embarrassing silences. You don't know. So I can make you talk. I will make you talk. So yeah. So what happens is you start putting in more massive clocks, more and more energy, more and more photons, and space-time begins to curve and warp under the presence of these clocks and signals. Well, that's okay, it's still fine. It's still mapping out the space-time that's warping under the influence of all this energy in the form of clocks and signals they're putting into it. But at a certain point, you put in so much energy that a horizon forms and undergoes gravitational, this part of your GPS network undergoes gravitational collapse and it forms a black hole. And now there's nothing wrong with forming a black hole, right? Many of my favorite computers have ended their lives as black holes. Right? But you know, it's not good if a part of your GPS network forms a black hole. Let's just face it. Okay. So if we say that, if we're going to say that from the outside, we don't want any part of our GPS network to be at greater than the black hole density, we're going to demand that to be the case. And in point of fact, even if it does form a black hole, so part of the network forms a black hole, and the rest of the GPS network outside is measuring space-time geometry around this black hole, so far as they're concerned, here's this black hole, which is at the black hole density. So our demand is going to be simply that we're not going to allow things to be denser than a black hole. Fair enough? I'll try to make this more precise in a kind of generally covariant way in just a bit, but for the moment, let's just say that that's the case. And what that says is that, wrong piece of chalk, sorry. What that says, but no black hole, or that this piece of the GPS network is not at greater than the black hole density, even if it is a black hole, okay? No black hole implies that the radius of this is greater than or equal to the Schwarzschild radius. I guess, yeah, we'll say we'll allow it to be a black hole if you want, but it can't be denser than a black hole, which is equal to 2gm over c squared, which because e equals mc squared, a feature, whenever you can actually legitimately use the formula e equals mc squared, you should, right? So 2e over 2ge over c to the fourth. All right? So it's not going to be bigger than the black hole density. So, and I pop this in here, and what I find is, well, I'm going to have E, the energy is less than or equal to R, okay? Time is time. And this, if I put these together, I get this number of ticks and clicks or elementary events. There's this factor of 2 right here, and what I get is if I get this right, I think I have a C to the fourth, I have an H bar, I have a G, I have a pi, and I have a R, and I have a T. And this is equal to RT over pi times the Planck length times the Planck time. Okay? This is a very simple derivation. Does everybody believe that this, I did the algebra right? So the number of events that you can cram into the space-time volume is no greater than RT over pi the Planck length times the Planck time. And how did I derive it? I just derived it by using just very basic physics of computation stuff, Margolis-Levitin theorem, quantum speed limit stuff, and then simply demanding that the energy within this volume be not so great that it be a black hole. Or that even if it is a black hole, that according to somebody outside, it's no more dense than a black hole can be. So I didn't do anything about quantum gravity or anything like that. Nonetheless, the Planck length and the Planck time showed up here. They showed up because to invoke the quantum limits to measurement, I had to invoke h bar, which tells you, because the Planck scale tells you how rapidly you can do stuff at a local level given a certain amount of energy. And to relate this to the requirement that this thing not be denser than a black hole, I had to bring in g. And since the only other two parameters in this thing are r and t, it's got to be something like this. Except, of course, you might not have guessed this factor of pi. So it's got to be something like this. Except it could also have been r squared over lp squared, or r cubed over lp cubed. So I think this is actually kind of surprising, because if you take naively, the number of events within some volume of space-time is just proportional to the volume, divided by the smallest pixelation of the volume that you could get, this picture that the vacuum is just burbling with all these virtual particles, et cetera, and mapping out space and time as it goes, then you might say, r cubed over lp cubed. Or if you're like an adherent to holography and you think that, in some sense the bits in the system are like somehow two-dimensionally projected onto the boundary of the system at a Planck scale, you'd guess r squared over lp squared. But no, the answer is rt over lp. It's just r over lp, t over tp. This is very sparse, much sparser than you would guess from ordinary arguments, from hand-waving kinds of arguments of the kind that I made about something like vacuum energy or holography or something like that. Indeed, what it says, let me now try to erase this stuff. What it says is that there is an essentially two-dimensional, some weird two-dimensional character to this quantum geometric limit. So this is something we call the quantum geometric limit, because it's a limit to how accurately you can determine the geometry of space-time. So we figure sphere in some way. It suggests some kind of funny space-time holography. So by holography here, I know that everybody here knows what holography is, but because it's colloquial, I'll say it anyway. So the ordinary notion of holography in general relativity in quantum mechanics is that you can imagine, this was proposed by Gerard and Hooft and Lenny Susskind a long time ago now, you're encouraged to imagine, as I just mentioned, every bit within some space-like three volume as being projected holographically on the two-dimensional surface of that volume, and in a density no greater than the Planck scale, or the Planck length squared. There's a kind of area entropy law. There's entropy in the bits, and this entropy in the bits corresponds to an area on the surface, the space-like two surface that bounds the space-like three volume. I tried to draw this, but I think it's better to do as kind of an interpretive modern dance, right? So, but here, in this quantum geometric limit, we are encouraged to imagine not each bit, but each bit flip. So each, let me call it an op, right? Because an op is a bit flip in quantum in computation, right? Each op or elementary event, elementary quantum event, as projected onto a two-dimensional surface. Again, it's in holography, the bits are projected onto a two-dimensional space-like surface, but here we're supposed to imagine these events as being projected onto a one plus one-dimensional surface. In fact, I kind of drew it right here, right? Because I was required by the fact that I had to draw this on a two-dimensional surface, I drew this kind of what should be a three plus one-dimensional picture of clocks ticking and detectors clicking. I drew it and projected it onto a one plus one dimensional surface, a space-time surface, I'll even like call it, you know, in the nod to the string theorists in the audience, I'll call this a world sheet if you like, just to be like provocative and suggestive. You don't have to call that if you don't feel like it. And the density is no greater than order of the Planck length squared. Or Planck length times Planck time, let's say. So if to do this projection, the idea is if I were to pixelate this with little things of like the size of Planck length squared, and I were to look at all these events, then I shouldn't have a density that's greater than that. It's a funny result. I mean, who here finds this like so prosaic? Who here finds this strange or novel? Okay, who here finds it just ordinary and boring? Oh, come on. It's weird. I mean, so this was really easy to do, as you can see. I mean, in some sense, this is a lot more, deriving this quantum geometric limit in the space-time holography is in some sense a lot more straightforward than the holographic principle, which is a principle, not some kind of theorem. This is just, you know, I showed you how there was no, I didn't like, you know, I have nothing up my sleeves. So I showed you the whole thing. It's like a back of the envelope kind of calculation. But it's a back of the envelope calculation that leads to a kind of surprising consequence. I'm not sure to see it. Okay, my sleeves, sorry. So it leads to a kind of surprising consequence that essentially each elementary event corresponds in this volume of space-time, in some funny sense, corresponds to some kind of Planckian area. In this case, area that we imagine is projected onto this world sheet across this volume. Yeah?
This has a question about the notion of it.
Uh-huh.
If I want to flip 10 bits versus 1 bit,
yeah.
That's still just 1
off. Right, exactly.
So if I have many events that are supposed to happen in parallel,
yeah.
And there's only one result that has to come out.
Right.
No,
we're going to call that just one op. So essentially an op is going to be system goes from state to orthogonal state. Okay. Because I can always construct some, in fact, we have a paper on this for communication purposes, I can always construct some funky nonlinear Hamiltonian that will, you know, take this, all these bits from the state, you know, plus, 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 to the state minus, 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 and with a nonlinear interaction in one shot. And so, in fact, you can build such devices. So, well, I'm going to be quite careful and say that an op is, let's just use op for an event. An event is something goes, you know, something that I'm let's be even more specific. So I'm going to give you an operator, right, which may be time dependent, okay, because as we're going to see in just a second, you know, the question of whether a state has gone from an initial state to an orthogonal state is an observer dependent, question. All right. So, but we're going to say here is the state. Here is the other state in somebody's reference frame. Are these two states orthogonal to each other? But that's a very good point. So I want to be quite precise about this. So, you happy with that? Yeah. More questions? Because I mean, this is the end of part one, and I'm right on schedule. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So people are bringing up points which are quite important. They're basically saying, hey, this is not covariant, all right? So let's make this covariant is the next step. But before I make it covariant, do people have more comments or questions about this? Anybody back there? I can't see myself. Okay, yeah. So this quantum geometric limit—it's a funky result. I mean, maybe less well known than I would like it to be, but now everybody's here, so at least I told you about it, right? And it's very suggestive. It's very suggestive. And so what I'm going to do in the second half of the talk is I'm going to say first of all, let's make this covariant to deal with the issues that people wisely and importantly bring up. You know. E times T is not a covariant quantity, right? So let's make it covariant. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to do it the other way around. So I'm going to show that if each elementary quantum event of something going from one state to an orthogonal state is associated with a Planck scale area, then that implies Einstein's equations in a straightforward fashion. So here I derived this using, actually I didn't really derive very much, and I didn't use Einstein's equations very much, you've got to admit, right? Einstein's equations imply this black hole limit, but all I was saying, hey, you know, nothing's denser than a black hole, plus physics of information processing, quantum geometric limit. So this is, in some sense, a much less stringent set of assumptions than the ones that go normally into getting Einstein's equations. So it would be pretty cool if you could actually start from the notion that, hey, each op is somehow associated with some Planck scale area, and then get Einstein's equations. And I'll show you that that's possible to do. All right. So let me make this covariant. Oops, sorry, I seem to be making noise while I erase the board. So there's two things that we need to do. We need to make covariant, we need to make notion of this, a covariant definition of this volume of space and time. So this was, remember, this is like a three-dimensional sphere that we're following for time t. So first let's make this notion of this time cylinder, space-time 3 plus 1 cylinder, spherical in spatial extent, just like a line in temporal extent. Let's make that covariant. So this is easy to do. Make a covariant cylinder. So we just have a kind of a master clock. Here's our master clock, sticking away. Let's say that it's following these clocks. Note that these actually, from what I described, these clocks don't have to follow geodesic. I didn't never use that here. But for this part, let's make it follow geodesic, just for the heck of it. And essentially, we're going to send signals out to other folks, and the other folks, this could just be a mirror, the other folks are going to send the signals back. And you see, in the ordinary fashion, if I do this, I can define, by looking at signals that go out, back, and go out, and then come back, I can define a space-like free surface that is of radius r. And if I look at the envelope of this with more of these signals, then I can define a 3 plus 1 cylinder. Is this clear? It's pretty straightforward. I mean, and so everybody, you know, these events of this thing, these ticks of the clocks as in GPS, these events right here of where these signals get here and come back, this is just how you would define a sphere of radius r in GPS followed for a time t. No problem. So everybody happy with that? So the notion of a cylinder or following a sphere over time, or for that matter, any solid rotation, like the size of the sphere can grow and shrink, it's not a problem. And of course, you could also, you know, have it be varied as well, because the whole point of this is that we can, GPS is intrinsically a covariant way of mapping out space and time. Indeed, it probably, you know, it's a chicken and egg kind of thing, but maybe Einstein very well came up with the notion of covariance by saying, hey, you know, space and time is not like a metric. It's just some list of ticks of clocks and clicks of detectors. And that list is clearly covariant. You know, everybody agrees on the list. It's full of scalar quantities. It's not, you know, it doesn't change if you're a boosted observer. It's just a list. Okay, check. Now let's make this limit, Marmolus-Lanatin theorem, covariant. And here, we can do this quite simply. Because if now I look at some kind of segment, where should I draw it? Let's look at this segment right here. Let's call this delta x mu, some interval in space and time. Then what I can say is that I can just do the relativistically and general relativistically invariant and general relativistically covariant versions of this. I can just look at p mu, d mu, and delta p mu, d mu, and p mu, delta x mu. Okay, so with these clocks and signals, now everything is now nice and hunky-dory. Okay, at least on an individual clock and signal-like level, and we do still have to worry about things like interactions between clocks and signals. Yeah? Well, you're talking about who was responsible for these. This is like David Gross and other people write about this kind of stuff. So I'm not sure I agree with those results in the sense at a conceptual level, because I'm actually kind of claiming that the metric doesn't exist in some sense, except for this list of ticks and clicks. Sorry, let me just finish. Except for this list of ticks and clicks. So I'm not so sure that I necessarily buy those extended uncertainty relationships that have this uncertainty in the metric. I mean, to my mind, these actually imply an intrinsic uncertainty in the metric, because they imply an uncertainty about when the signal arrived and what happened in between these ticks of the clocks. So in some sense, so maybe I should put these in quotes, okay? Because what this really is, of course, is, what we're really looking at is we're counting these ticks of clocks and looking at the clicks of detectors, and we're asking how accurately, we're measuring energy in the frame of mass of an inertial clock. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so this is necessarily going to be vague, and thank you for bringing that up. And I think this should be in quotes, because we don't know what the metric actually is. Okay, good. Perfect. That makes my life. So you're making me happy. So good. So I don't need a metric. That's what Lee says. Now I'd love to believe that that's true. So I'll now assume that it's true. Sorry. Yeah. We don't. Yeah. Right. Okay. Right. That's a very good point. Right. So I think maybe that is related to the fact that these kinds of quantities, independent of what p mu means and x mu means, are the things that we deduce from looking at this diagram. Right. So if I say what are p mu and x mu, it's stuff that we're going to infer from looking at this list of ticks of clocks and clicks of detectors. Somebody, sorry, up there.
I was just going to ask if you maybe repeat that little exchange that happened just here.
I'm sorry? Lee said that X is covariant and P is contravariant, or is it the other way around? And so I don't need a metric to contract them. They're already contractible without a metric. So I don't have to assume a metric. Okay?
It still begs the question how you measure a delta P.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. But I think that, those things are, if a good way to think of this is you imagine you're in some volume of space-time and you're trying to measure this by what's happening to your clocks and these signals. But I don't have a precise answer to that, so I totally agree. Yeah?
So do you need to sum over mu?
Yeah, that's an implicit sum over mu. Yeah, so this is, one of the whole reasons for this is to get rid of the whole notion of a metric, right? I mean, the metric is something in this picture. So in my quantum mechanical engineering way of trying to quantize gravity, I ask, well, what are the observables of the metric? Now, normally people say, oh, g mu nu is a metric and we can observe features of it. But what I would say here is that the observables in the system are, at time tick number 233, photon arrived from clock number 27. And the metric is then to be derived from that. This is a very safe way of doing it, right? Because it's completely covariant because it's just a list of signals and clocks. All right? Sorry, yeah?
So you replace this E, which is the energy minus the ground state.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what?
Oh yeah, so let me tell you what happened. Thank you. I'll regard that as a sign for me to move on. So let me actually now, so what I'm gonna do is I'm just gonna describe what gets replaced, what the E times T product gets replaced by generically in general relativity. And this is just something that you can find in, for example, Hawking and LS, or for that matter, Misner, Thorne, and Wheeler, or you know, textbooks on general relativity. So what we're gonna have is, imagine we have a swarm of clocks. So let's step back and not even think about quantum mechanics for a second, okay? And imagine what someone just ordinarily in general relativity would say, well, what is this energy time product for some volume of space and time? So, if you knew the metric and you knew the geometry, okay? So we have a swarm of clocks. They're following some set of integral curves. So these are the lines that the clocks are following. They don't necessarily have to be GED6, okay? So a swarm of clocks, they follow, and there is so I'm filling space and time with a swarm of clocks. And I'm gonna call this is the tangent vector to the set of integral curves. So these are the integral curves of the sum set V mu, which are the tangent vectors at different points in space and time. So this is V mu at x, some point x, this is V mu at some point x prime. So these are the tangent vectors. All right, so are people happy with that? So now I'm gonna ask, how does this local clock, if it's looking at some chunk, well maybe I'll put it like this, some chunk of matter with an energy density, T mu nu, stress energy tensor of T mu nu, what does it say the energy is? All right, so is everybody happy with this? This is just like, this is a very conventional general relativity exercise at the moment, just classical general relativity. Well, the point is that in some little volume of space and time, basically, T mu nu, V mu, V nu, V mu, V nu, is equal to minus one, so these are unit tangent vectors, then T mu nu, V mu nu is equal to the energy density according to this observer on this clock, local observer. Let's say the local clock, we'll full-heartedly just merge clocks and observers for this, according to a local clock, and then this energy time product, is the integral over the volume of space and time that I'm interested in, let's say I call it that or something like that, of T mu nu, V mu nu, V mu, V nu, squared minus G dV. And this is supposed to be less than, this is equal to, quote, E times T, and so this is supposed to be, 2 this, over pi h bar is less than or equal to the total number of events. So I didn't draw this very well. V mu, V nu, and this is the square root of minus g. So if I ask about, just a second, if I have this set of clocks, I follow their integral terms, I look at their tangent vectors, I ask locally how do they define how much energy there is available, then this is what they say. Yeah, Lee. Oh, sorry. This is d4x. Sorry. This is energy, spatial energy density.
Right.
So this is the integral over space gives me energy, and then the integral over time gives me time. The integral over time. So this is energy is the integral over space of the energy density, and then time. Great. If you were confused about that, I bet other people were too as well. So, yeah. I'm sorry.
Give inequalities.
Sorry. Oh, greater than or equal to, yeah, thanks, absolutely. Good, you get like, if any students, when my classes, if students correct me, then their grade just automatically goes up. The more they correct me, the more the grade up goes up to a certain point, after which they go down, goes down again. But you don't know exactly when you reach that point, right? So you might as well just keep on trying. Okay. So this is the covariant version of our limit on the number of events. This is our covariant definition of a cylinder. And basically I say, okay, if this volume V is this covariant cylinder, then according to observers that are moving on clocks that are moving through this cylinder, the total number of events can be no greater than 2 over pi h bar of this integral right here. All right? So that makes it covariant. Yeah?
Why should the total number of events in this case have to depend at all on the volume?
Because this is a really good question. Yeah, so in fact, I labored under the delusion for a long time that the total number of events was a scalar quantity. Now, actually, ticks of clocks and clicks of detectors, those are scalar quantities because they're defined locally. But suppose that an event is that a particle that is here moves here, right? So it's got some wave function, and then it moves to a point where its wave function no longer overlaps. Now, it moved to an orthogonal state according to an observer where it's moving, right? An observer that's moving, going with the particle, says, it didn't move to an orthogonal state, it's still where it was. So there are actually two kinds of events here. There are these kind of scalar-like events, which are things like ticks of clocks and clicks of detectors. And then there are vector or tensorial events. So vector events are like this particle moved from here to there. So, and one has to take them both into account, right? So it actually is not the number of events or the number of this energy time, this covariant energy time product is observer dependent. And the things that are observer dependent are these, you know, did this particle move from here to there? This clock says, one clock says yes, the other clock says no. So maybe one thing you'd like to do, for instance, here would be to minimize this quantity, right? And in fact, if you, I'm quite sure that if you have a perfect fluid, and these V mu's, so the clocks form a perfect fluid, and these V mu's are the tangents to the flow lines of the perfect fluid, that this quantity is actually minimized. Because the reason being that the V mu represent a time, a local reference frame in which the fluid is at rest. So all other things that are moving with respect to it will say, oh, its energy is high. So it's a very good point that you raise. Because there are some things, there are events that are associated with scalar quantities, those are invariant, that number is invariant, everybody agrees on them. But then there are events that are associated with vectorial quantities, or maybe tensorial quantities, like things having to do with the electromagnetic field, and those may be observer dependent. Because the operator that says, where is the particle, is not the same for somebody moving. Okay? Yeah, good, great, yeah. Yeah. So I asked for your forbearance over here, just to say, hey, let's just like look at like page 55 of Hawking and Ellis, and like say, what's the, you know, I have a perfect fluid of clocks. What do they say the energy time product is as they measure it locally? So without any quantization of nothing, you know. So right. So absolutely, you're absolutely right. Yeah. Oh yeah, sorry about that. If you wanted to have it be a density, sure, absolutely. Let's get rid of it. I mean, depending how you define it, right? If it's a tensor, then it is a square root of g minus g. If it's tensor density, then it's like then there's no square root of minus g.
Right. But the right way to do it is it's density.
I've seen it written in both ways.
So. That's
what you want. Okay. Sure. As you desire. I aim to please. I try to satisfy people if I can. Some people. That's right. That's right. That's right. I certainly don't try to satisfy all people all the time. In fact, some people I try to annoy all the time. Like actually, Frank Wilczek, I like to try to annoy him all the time, and he says that I'm succeeding. He is easily annoyed, so it's just so much fun to annoy. That's why he makes it easy. All right. So in the last half hour, so these, thank you for all these great questions. So this was just some kind of classical thing, okay? So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to derive Einstein's equations from this kind of picture. I'm going to assume that there is a metric, okay? I don't necessarily know what it is. And I'm going to assume that in some sense, these events in space and time are associated with some Planck scale area. So each event corresponds to some Planck scale area. And I'll tell you just what area this is in just a second. It's really the only one that one could think of, that I could think of. It turns out that the one that stands to mind, springs to mind immediately, is the right one. And by associating each event with a Planck scale area, I can say if there is a metric, then the metric obeys Einstein's equations. All right, so I will postulate a metric, which we don't know what it is, okay? But I'm going to say, oh, okay, let's see if there is a metric with a certain assumption, what's going to happen with it. I'm just trying to, first of all, your excellent and well-deserved questions. And while I write down a metric, and you say, well, what is this metric, right? So we don't know what the metric is, but let's suppose there is one, and let's see what kind of equations it is. So, people okay? Because I'm going to go on to, this is the last part of the talk. And for that, I'm going to get rid of this stuff. This is going to need some general relativity, but that's OK. They kindly gave me brand new chalkboard erasers, but still, chalkboard seems kind of hard to erase. Okay, let me see if I can draw this. I've never drawn this picture before. Since the first part of this talk I've given a bunch of times. This part I've never given, and the last part I've never given. So, and since I'm making it up as I go along, as you can probably tell, well, not making up the equations or anything like that as I go along, but I'm just saying whatever occurs to me to say, the right thing at the right point. Give me some. We'll see if I can actually draw this at the same time. In fact, drawing it while talking might be tough. Okay. Okay. So let's look at this one observer. Here's this one observer, and this is its world line. Let's just draw it in a way, so this is just some small section of its world line, so I'm going to draw it for the moment as being straight. Okay? And we're going to set up a orthonormal tetrad, okay? So I'm going to call this E sub 0 mu, I'm going to call this E sub 1 mu, I'm going to call this E sub 2 mu, and I can't draw E sub 3 mu. I could draw it anywhere, but it would look confusing, so I'm not going to draw it. But there are four of them. So E sub A mu is an orthonormal tetrad which, for those of us who know about general relativity, and of course I'm very scared because there are many people here who know much more about it than I do, but I'll say it anyway, or Fierbein, an idea which I think was first introduced by Weyl, is that right? I'm not sure. And it has the feature that if eta AB is just the ordinary Minkowski space metric, so diagonal, plus, minus, plus, plus, plus. I'm following Hawking and Ellis and using metrics with signature minus, plus, plus, plus. we have that eta AB, E A mu, E B nu is equal to the metric. So that this thing is like, well, all this is really, this orthonormal tetrad is something that this observer carries with him to say, you know, by gum, I'm going to set up something, a set of coordinates that looks like Minkowski space where I am right here. And then I'm going to see what happens. Okay? And it has a feature that when you contract these, this is summation for this is a summation convention, so this gets summed over. When I have two things on the bottom and the top, they always get summed over. So it has this relation that it is related to this metric, which we don't know in this fashion. Our goal is to actually find out what this G mu nu is. But, you know, I hope you're okay with me, like, with as an observer setting up, like, a locally orthonormal tetrad. And the other feature that it has is that, the fact this is, of course, that it's orthonormal. G mu nu Did I do this right? So, oh yeah, g mu nu e mu a e nu b is equal to eta a b. This means it's orthonormal, all right? So I'm declaring it to be orthonormal. And now we're going to see what happens to this system, okay? Is everybody happy with this? This is when Weil wrote about this, it's a nice paper by Weil, that he said, oh, well, that's like, he was trying to understand general relativity in a way, in his own inimitable fashion, different from how Einstein had made it. Initially, he said, let's just imagine that these observers are carrying their own little reference frame with them, and let's see what happens to this reference frame. Does it get kind of morphed as time goes on? Okay? Everybody happy? Yeah? No, it's just one place and one time. It's just like here, and we're going to see what it's something, you know, because this is stuff, shit happens, right? So it's not necessarily going to be, we don't know how it's going to be related to itself at different times in space. Okay, so now let me, let's see, I want to draw more of this picture. I'm actually going to erase, you guys remember what eta is, okay? And you remember this is an orthonormal tetrad. So I'll leave this orthonormal here, and we'll see if I can draw this right here. So now let me, so how can I associate some kind of funny Planck scale area with this? So let me draw a little cube centered at the point of this observer. So it's a little hard for me to, let's see, I don't know exactly how to do this. This, here's this cube, it comes out over here. It's actually a 4 cube, but I can't show it that way. And so this part exits, this thing exits in the center here. This observer sits at the center of this cube. All right? And the edges of the cube are oriented along the Fehrbein, along the tetrad. Okay. Now, we're going to identify, for this purposes, we're going to define an op to be basically any time I accrue a phase of, you know, average phase of pi over 2 relative to the ground state, we're going to call that an op. So we're just going to, from this point on, we're going to call this number this here. And this, by the way, is a subtle question, and I don't know, I mean, I think that it's something that could definitely be worth discussing. But let's just for the moment say, what is an op? An op is when some chunk of stuff acquires, and, you know, whether a locally defined energy eigenstate acquires a phase of pi relative to the ground state, something like that. Okay. So we're just going to call this energy time product the number of ops that go in here. Now, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to do the following. Here's the rule. So for each op, I'm going to remove an area, which is going to be something like, I'm going to call it alpha LP squared. Let's take Planck time and Planck length. I don't want to deal with speeds of light here, so let's take the speed of light to be 1. From a suitable place. And where we're going to remove it from? What we're going to remove it from is the following. So at the center of this sphere here, oh, sorry, of this cube right here, there are 6 sections. Which are defined by, you know, E sub 0 sub mu cross, you know, E sub 1 sub mu, etc. So the 6 products E sub mu A, well, I've got something made up like this, so E sub A sub mu by E sub B sub mu, where A doesn't equal B. Sub mu, I should make this a mu, sorry. So for instance, the section of this cube, which is E1, which corresponds to E0 and E1, is the one that's just in the plane of the board, as I've drawn it right here. And then there's another one, which is E1 and E2, and that's going along this plane right here. So are people okay by that? There's 6 of them. So, and I don't know what this proportionality constant alpha is, but it's going to be something of order 1. Turns out it's going to be pi squared over 3, as it turns out, but that's okay. So this is my rule. It's a very simple rule. All it says, really, if you think about it, is that the existence of a an op within this, if a bit gets flipped or something happens, an elementary quantum that occurs within this cube, then essentially it kind of curves in the boundaries of this cube by some small amount. Because if you take a flat surface and like one of these sections and you remove some area from it, you cause it to curve. I tried to get a balloon when I went out for a walk because to show how this is, but you know, maybe I can do it just, it's like, I take something, I remove some area, and I induce curvature, in this case at a point. But if I imagine this as being just kind of gently making this thing curve here. So the sections get area removed from it, the whole cube acquires a slight curve. Okay? And my rule is only that I'm just going to remove this from a total amount of area from these 6 sections. I'm not specifying anything further. Are people okay with this? Remove area makes this is, the nice thing about this is that these sections are 2-dimensional, so it's easy to imagine their curvature, whereas I personally have a hellish time trying to imagine curvature in even 3 and in 4 dimensions. But in 2 dimensions, I know it, because it's just Gaussian curve, ordinary Gaussian curvature of a 2-dimensional surface. All right? So that's the rule. And now I'm going to show that this implies T mu nu, G mu nu obey Einstein's equations. Oops, Einstein's. Equations. So this is going to be, let's see. Where shall I think I'll just have to erase this right here. You have to admit it's a simple rule. It was the first thing that occurred to me, and it's lucky that it worked because I would have been too lazy to try anything more had it failed. So the area removed is equal to alpha times this number, and that is in turn is equal, we're going to call it alpha times 2 over pi h bar times the integral over this little cube. And actually, we're just going to call this, so now this little cube is small, so we're just going to call this t mu nu e, well, I'll do it up here, t mu nu e 0 mu E zero nu times delta 4, if this edge of the cube is delta. So T mu nu E naught mu nu, this is just the energy density in this cube. With the delta cube, that gives me the total energy in the cube, and the last power of delta gives me the time product. Okay, so this is just the infinitesimal version of what I had before. Now, what is the area removed? Well, the area removed is equal to K, I'm going to call this what? Delta to the 4 over 12 times the Gaussian curvature of each of these cross sections. So I'll just write it like this. Sum over A not equal to B, K, A, B. And this is just the Gaussian curvature. The ordinary Gaussian curvature of these sections. Right? This is the relationship between curvature and area for Gaussian curvature. Yeah. But I'm supposed to at 3:30, right? It was 3? That's funny. I thought on the schedule it said 3:30. Oh, that's bad. It does say 3:30. Is it okay? Okay, 3:30 is all right? Because I can do it by 3:30, but if I have to do it by negative 15 minutes, I can't do it. I'd have to bring in one of our closed timeline curves, which is another story. Oh yeah, well, I'm almost there. And I think this deserves a bunch of discussion, because I hope that it deserves a bunch of discussion. So I hope that people will tell me stuff about this. Okay. So this Gaussian curvature right here. So now this is the ordinary relationship between air and Gaussian curvature. So this is nothing even particularly general relativistic or anything about it. It's just like area and curvature relationship. But if you look at E, A, mu, E, A, nu, together with the Ricci tensor, then this is equal to the sum over, so these Gaussian curvatures are actually related to the general relativistic kind of quantity, which in this case is the Ricci tensor. And the relationship is the following. If I look along a particular direction, let's take it to be the zero direction, because that's easy for me. Now there are three sections that are go across that participate in this direction right here. There are three of them. And this is just equal to the sum for B does not equal A of K A B. So the point is that there's a relationship which comes from the fact that this Gaussian curvature is identical with what's called the sectional curvature of this section. And it's easy to derive from that. This is very standard stuff. It goes back like 50 or 60 years or more, that you can relate the sums of the Gaussian curvatures in these three sections to the contraction of the Ricci tensor with this line right here. I'm not going to prove this, but I'm just going to ask you to accept it as a well-known fact out of general relativity. Okay? So that in turn means and I'll try to finish up within less than 5 minutes. Okay. And then we'll at least 5 minutes for questions. So if I write this out now, what I get is I have alpha times our number, which is equal to 2 alpha over pi h bar t mu nu e mu 0 e mu 0. The kind of energy time product as viewed by this local observer, with this rule that all we do is we just like take out this tiny amount of area from this. This is now equal to 1/2, and I'm not going to sum over these things. This is a non-contracted sum. So r mu nu e zero nu plus r mu nu e one nu plus r. Well, let me just write it. Well, yes, I'm already on that road, so I'll just do it. 2 e 2 nu plus r nu nu e 3 nu e 3 nu. I'm writing this out to emphasize that this is a sum, and I don't want to contract these indices right here. You know, you see, the reason that there's a factor 1/2 is because when I add up each one of these things, I'm counting each section twice. So in order to go back to this KAB, then it's that quantity there divided by 1/2. But it doesn't take very long to see that this is just actually equal to this is actually equal to r mu nu minus g mu nu over 2 times r, or r rho, rho. I'll just call it r, the Ricci scalar, contracted with, I should put these up here, upstairs, excuse me, e mu 0, e nu 0. If you just go through it, I mean, if you actually just write this out, you see, you put this in, it's like, oh, this has length minus 1, and you write this out, and you find that this quantity is the same as this quantity right here, which in turn is equal to the sum over AB of K, A not equal to B of KAB. And now, you know, this is equal to 2 alpha pi over H bar T mu nu, right? Times contracted with E0 mu, E0 nu. So this is just this, you know, total amount of, this is the energy time product as viewed by the local observer. We say, oh, let's just remove a little Planckian area for each kind of op we pop into that. That takes up this amount of area right here, and that implies that T mu nu contracted with E naught nu, which is just the timeline of this observer, is G mu nu, the Einstein. You know, this is G mu nu, E mu, E zero nu. And now we'll note that if all we demand, that if this holds for any local observer, I didn't make any specifications about this observer, it doesn't have to be someone with a local rest frame or anything like that, but if it holds for any local observer, then it implies that Einstein's equations. Because if it has to hold for any local observer, it has to hold for any E0, and then it's just got to hold in general. If alpha is equal to pi squared over 3. Okay. So we have a few minutes left, so let me just review what just happened here. So first half of the talk, I just gave some very general and hard to argue with, I feel, arguments about how, if we look at the physics of information processing, or really the physics, fundamental physics of measurement, you know, bits flipping or clocks ticking or detectors clicking, that we can put, if we combine that with the notion that there's nothing denser with a black hole, then we can get a simple limit called the quantum geometric limit, which is a kind of space-time holography. The quantum geometric limit, just in the way that the holographic principle encourages us to look at bits as being projected on a space-like two surface, the quantum geometric limit urges us to think about events or ops as being projected on a two surface again. So then in the second half of the talk, after making this quantum geometric limit into a covariant statement, which wasn't very hard, really, after making it into a covariant statement, then I said, well, let's do just like Jacobson did in 1994 to try to turn the tails on, sorry, what's the, 95, thank you, sorry, excuse me. Well, he did it in 94 and he published it in 95. Right, as he published it in 1995. Sorry, as Jacobson did in 1995, well, let's not argue about this. somewhere along the tick of this clock down there. So Jacobson said, hey, let's take holography, or like the area entropy law, combine it with the notion that that accelerated observers see radiation at a certain temperature, and then let's try to derive Einstein's equations from that. So what I said here is like, oh, okay, hey, we've got this space-time holography that associates events or ops with some kind of Planck scale area, encourages us to think of the world that way. So let's just see if we can't do the same thing. So what I did in the last part of the talk is I assumed, okay, quantum geometric limit holds with equality. So we're just going to define an op to be something acquires a phase of pi relative to the ground state, the local ground state. And then I said, oh, let's associate this with an area. And the area is very simply, it's just going to be the area removed, you know, without discriminating between the six different sections of this local cube, I just remove the area from these six different sections. I don't know how I do it exactly, but I'm just going to remove that amount of area from these six sections. And then, by a rather simple argument, which relies only actually really on this notion of this Gaussian curvature of these sections here, the sectional curvature, then you get the fact that Einstein's equations hold. So, I think it's kind of a funky set of results. This last stuff is like hot off the press, actually, or should be showing up on the archive tomorrow. It's the work of the last, I've been working on this for years, but you know, this stuff I figured out sometime in the last few months. And I think it gives a nice picture. To me, it suggests that there's something out there. I mean, I'm not claiming that this is a derivation of quantum gravity or a theory of quantum gravity. But I think that this set of relationships says, wow, maybe there's something here. And perhaps we could go further in understanding quantum mechanics of gravity by looking at this gravity in these terms. So don't quantize. So I guess I'll end with my quantum mechanical engineer's model, which is quantize GPS, not the metric. Let's quantize the things that are the observables of the system, rather than some unobservable quantity. And if you do that, fun stuff happens. That's it. Thank you very much.